morning. I'm Michael Cathcart, and you are so very, very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. Today you'll meet the wonderful Indian author Dipti Kapoor. Her debut novel, A Bad Character, is about city life and its dangers for middle-class girls, and it's a story that's raised a few eyebrows.
I've had a few women, really annoyed. I have really provoked them, and this is not the kind of reaction I anticipated. I thought there'd be some right-wing Hindu men getting upset with the book, and it's been interesting.
Yes, well, if you're not upsetting somebody, you're not doing your job, I reckon. And the bedroom philosopher, Justin Hazelwood, he brings you the first in a special 8-part series about being fun employed. It's about life as it really is for an artist in Australia. Today, the art of selling yourself as an artist. That's later in the show. Well, now, you might have heard the news that Harper Lee, the author of the classic 1960 novel To Kill a Mockingbird, is set to release a second book, a sequel, in fact, to her classic novel. She's now aged 88, and it's been a staggering 54 years since she wrote Mockingbird. So what's this all about? We're joined on the line from the USA by Harper Lee's biographer, Charles J. Shields. Charles, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure.
Was this news that there was another book waiting in the wings? Did you know about this?
Yes, I did. When I was researching her biography in 2004, 2005, I came across evidence of another novel. It was clear to me that this was a work by a beginning author, a young woman in her 20s who was looking for a publisher. And I also saw evidence of the fact that there were scenes and characters that would later appear in To Kill a Mockingbird. So I assumed that this was a draft, you know, an early attempt at To Kill a Mockingbird. It didn't have the guidance of an editor on it yet. And I assumed that, you know, like a lot of creative work, it just kind of died in the author's hands and didn't go any further. Because maybe a year later or so, there's mention of the manuscript that eventually became To Kill a Mockingbird in the correspondence. And I know that that went through three complete revisions. So, you know, on the one hand, Ghost Set of Watchmen is a different book. On the other hand, it's going to seem very, very familiar, I think, to readers.
Now, as I understand it, it's set after To Kill a Mockingbird. She wrote it first, as you've explained, but it all happens 20 years later. It's the characters we know from that much-loved book 20 years on. Is that your understanding?
Yes. Scout is now a woman in her 30s, about the author's age, who's coming back to the town she grew up in Alabama, and she reminisces with her elderly attorney father about the events of her childhood, and it's the story that we know as To Kill a Mockingbird. To an editor, this presents an immediate problem because it's all in flashback, and, you know, there's no bigger suspense killer than something that's already occurred, because the characters involved came through it all right, evidently. But, you know, there could be some advantages to this. Perhaps we're going to see another aspect of Harper Lee's love for her father as an adult woman. Perhaps from the perspective of the 1950s, looking back to the Great Depression, we're going to see some strong contrast between then and now, that sort of thing. So, I mean, there is possibility here, but there also seems potential for a lot of overlap.
Yes. I mean, what you're referring to there is that Atticus Finch, the father, this heroic lawyer, this honest man, so memorable from the film, of course, is based closely on Harper Lee's own father, who was a lawyer of exactly that kind.
What does
the existence of this prior manuscript tell us about the writing of To Kill a Mockingbird, do you think?
Every good published author gets edited. It's something you just accept with your career. If you're a prima donna who turns away at suggestions that you need to rework something, you're probably not going to be published. And Harper Lee, to her eternal credit, took guidance from an editor, a woman in her 60s, who told her that she was a good natural storyteller, but that the novel needed work in terms of structure and point of view. And so Harper Lee took her at her word. The two women worked very closely together. And the result was a book that shows the fingerprints of a good editor all over it, and that's why we have To Kill a Mockingbird.
So are you cautious, Charles, about the quality of this upcoming publication?
Well, I am, sure, because, you know, as a literary biographer, I know that in the history of writing, authors don't usually like their early work to come to light. It's a period of apprenticeship when they're finding their way. I wonder if an 88-year-old blind woman who had a major stroke 5 years ago understands the import of what this might mean.
So do you think it's unwise to be publishing this manuscript?
Well, I'll tell you what. The manuscript did not come out during the entire half century that it existed and her elder sister, Alice Lee, was alive. Alice Lee was Harper's attorney, advisor, counselor, somebody who handled all of his finances. Alice just passed away at 103 in November, and here we are 2 months later. A manuscript has been uncovered. And my sense is that with Alice gone as a buffer, Harper Lee may be getting poor advice.
I guess time will tell. The book's due out on the 14th of July. Charles, thank you for joining us. It's been lovely to talk.
Well, thanks very much.
Charles J. Shields. His books include Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, and I Am Scout, The Biography of Harper Lee. Those are both published by Holt. And as I say, the new book, or the old new book, called Go Set a Watchman, will be on the shelves on the 14th of July. This is Books and Arts on RN. Now, whose ringtone is this?
Hi, Mum. Is that your phone?
Mm. Jimmy.
Nina, your apartment's on fire.
Oh, it's work. I've got it. Hello?
Yes, it's Nina Proudman from the hit TV series Offspring. We've had 5 series of Offspring. It's been a huge success for Channel 10. And you'd think that the creator of the series, Deborah Oswald, could now rest on her laurels. But no. Oh, no. She's been busy. She's been writing a novel. And it's called Useful. And it's the story... it's the story of a total loser, actually, who decides that the only way that he can give meaning to his life is to donate a kidney to a total stranger. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice to have you here.
Good to be here.
Sullivan is the man in question. Why is he so down on himself?
Well, he's one of those guys who was sort of, in his 20s, was smart and good-looking and charming enough, but he kind of was so lazy and in his soul a bit damaged, and life moved on. People turned into adults and he didn't.
No. And he's still borrowing money from his friends.
And drunk most of the time and letting people down, and he's just full of shame.
Hmm. Why don't you read us a little bit of the opening so we can get a taste
of
how it all works.
A fall from the 23rd story would be more than enough to do it. Access to the rooftop of a multi-story building turned out to be surprisingly easy. Sullivan had prepared a story. I'm a location scout wanting to suss out this rooftop as a possible film location. But in the end, he didn't need to bullshit anyone. The door to the roof stairs did carry a sign. No unauthorised access. But as Sullivan approached it, the door swung open from the outside. A handy piece of luck. A guy heading back inside leaned his weight against the heavy metal door, holding it open so Sullivan could get out. "Thanks, mate," Sullivan said, shuffling through the gap, his Hawaiian shirt lightly brushing the other man's stripy business shirt. That close, the smell of the guy was notable. Just smoked cigarette, plus the sour stink of last night's fags seeping through his pores. The man pressed his lips together in a sort of smile, a smile of mutual shame, assuming Sullivan was going outside to smoke too. As Sullivan stepped onto the rooftop, hearing the door thud closed, it occurred to him that the sad smoker was the last human being he would ever encounter.
Mm. Deborah Oswald reading the opening page of her new book, which is called Useful. So, as you can gather, listener, the book opens with him contemplating suicide. In fact, he mucks up his attempt to kill himself by jumping off the roof. Instead, he slips backwards on the roof and he knocks himself out. And that's the kicking off point for the story. Now, obviously, this is a pretty dangerous plot device because killing yourself is not funny.
No, it's absolutely not. And I hope I haven't implied that or made light of it. But I think life is ridiculous. Life is this very interesting brew of the ridiculous and the sad and the joyful. And I think that all those things can coexist in a story.
Yeah, I mean, this is the achievement of the book in a way, the first achievement anyway, that I started reading it and thought, oh, no, Deb, oh, no.
What have you done?
Oh, my Lord, you've got a guy jumping off the roof, he's going to top himself. This is not funny. This is going to play very, very badly. But actually, you totally get us there because his life has become an absurdity and
We're
with you. You know, I looked up suicide because I was going to say, you know, suicide's a terrible problem in Australia and, you know, you can't make jokes of it. Seven people kill themselves in Australia every day.
It's a huge thing.
But the other fact, as I read these figures, is that over half of those people are over 80. That's interesting, isn't it?
Oh.
So it's people, you know, making a decision to end their lives at a time when life is going to end anyway.
Of course.
So it's a complex issue.
That's a different category, I suppose,
yeah.
We would say.
Anyway, Sullivan wakes up in hospital and he makes the decision, which is really the thing that kicks off everything that happens in the book. He decides that he'll donate a kidney, that's going to make him useful.
So he's lying there in the hospital bed and he's thinking about the fact that he was going to smash all these perfectly healthy organs on the concrete. And he thinks, well, someone might as well get some benefit from my organs. So he'll do that.
Before they get... Yes.
So he fixes on that as a thing to keep himself going.
And then there's a kind of tension in the book because we start wondering, well, is he going to give away this kidney of his and then top himself?
Yes.
Is that what's going to happen? And then the other thing he's got to deal with is that you just can't walk into the renal unit and say, whip out the kidney and give it to a stranger.
No.
Partly because his kidneys are in such bad nick.
Well, his kidneys aren't bad. His liver's,
oh, his
not,
liver's,
in, his liver's not in great shape.
Yeah, his liver's not in bad. So they say, well, you've got to get healthy first.
Yes. And so, there's all these hurdles you have to get over, and including psychiatric assessment to be an altruistic donor. It's a very particular category of donor. So it's a kind of quest for him to – it's a quest story for him to pass all these tests.
He sees himself through the eyes of the nurse when he shows up at the renal unit. Perhaps just read us that one sentence where you, on page 28, where you give us a sense of how he knows that she sees him.
Well, he says, a homeless, unemployed, unloved man, overweight, under-muscled, greasy-haired, pasty-skinned, his forehead scabbed and bruised from the fall, one eyeball stained red thanks to a burst blood vessel, wearing paper underwear, over-eager like a panting Labrador, babbling at her about giving his kidney away to a stranger.
Yeah, he knows that's how
he
she
appears.
Sees him.
Yes.
Now, this is a challenge that you've set yourself, to write a book about a guy who is, to put it harshly, a loser.
Yes, although he does have a good heart, if he's got a thoughtlessness that means he often doesn't act on his good heart. I think he's a fundamentally decent human being. And he doesn't judge people, which I think is a very fine quality.
He's a decent human being in the way that regular people sort of tend to be decent.
I think that's right. But I wanted to make it as hard for myself as possible. I wanted to give him absolutely no grounds on which he could feel like a useful person.
So is that the way you think as a sort of dramatist? Is this the dramatist in you coming through? Because you've given him this enormous dramatic arc, this enormous narrative arc, as we say. You've set him way down one end.
Yes.
So the question is he going to get right up the other end and save himself?
He's got, in drama terms, we often talk about it as being he's got a lot of travel.
He does.
He's got a lot of travel. I think that's more fun. I think a lot of drama takes something that we all feel, like that anxiety that we all have about, am I a useful member of the planet?
Yeah.
And we take that and then exaggerate it. Because that's interesting and dramatic and funny and so forth. So I hope he does have a long way to go.
He does have a fair haul ahead of him.
But then he's also got some good raw materials in that he's basically a nice looking person who's let himself go to seed.
Yeah.
He's a smart person, and he's a kind person. So he's actually got quite a lot of resources.
Also, he's got an interesting social world. There are people who are looking after him, and his ex-wife is sort of making sure that someone looks after him.
Although he has used up his credit points with most of his friends.
Yes.
By burning things down and sleeping with their girlfriends, and he has, he has burned a lot of bridges.
He's not without flaws. This book is also a song in praise of radio producers.
It is! I can feel your producers behind me now, and I'd turn, except that I would be away from the microphone then.
Georgia Moody is the producer today. She's shouting hallelujah.
Yes, well, because my partner has worked in radio for a long time in Sydney ABC, I have observed radio producers up close, and I am always marvelling at their skill and poise and judgment and good humour.
Because you know that Richard Glover, your partner, actually is dull of wit, and the fact that he sounds so marvellous is because all these marvellous people tell you what to say.
Look,
is that what you're saying?
When you see a radio producer working on live radio in their control room, it is a splendid sight.
Yes, it is.
So one of the main characters in the book, Natalie, is a radio producer.
Yeah.
For the ABC.
Now, Richard Glover, well known to readers of the Sydney Morning Herald and to listeners of Sydney 702. Is your partner. You got together 35 years ago. I was pretty much there when you got together.
You witnessed it.
I did. And for years, Richard has been getting mileage out of writing about you. He always refers to you as Jocasta.
Yes.
Yeah, we're giving all this away. I suppose this has been a secret for 35 years. Well, this is Jocasta, ladies and gentlemen. We're meeting her today. And I've always found this very peculiar because Jocasta is the mother of Oedipus. It's an icky name to have.
I suppose. I was dubbed Jocasta when he wrote a column when one of our sons was little and was wanting to wrestle daddy to see who would win mummy, I think was the origin of that one.
Right.
But now I think Jocasta has, I think the name has a kind of quality that's just attached to the character I am in the column. And the thing about Jocasta is that I admire her. I think I'm nicer than her. Can you please attest to that?
Yes, you are a nice person.
But I think she's a formidable, wonderful woman.
Yeah. No, I'm pleased you're still known as Jocasta. My wife started to write about me as Prince Alfonso. But that was
You were Prince Lorenzo.
No, Alfonso it was. Oh. But that was many years ago. The name Prince Alfonso has not appeared in print for 15 years almost. I'm a bit disappointed that that hasn't gone on. So can we talk briefly about offspring? I don't want to sort of haul you back to something that's old news now. But how did it all come about? I mean, you had this great idea, did you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it came about, I've said this a number of times, is that all of television seemed to be full of dead bodies on slabs.
Yeah.
And I like death.
I mean, all those forensic shows?
Lots of forensic shows, and I mean, they still exist, and you know, and that's great. Good luck to them. And I have killed many people on stage.
I find it icky, to be honest. I find it really peculiar that go from station to station to station. There are people cutting up other dead people, and we're all watching it. I think it's very odd.
Quipping to each other while they do it.
Very
I know it's not my taste, but I accept that. I understand the appeal, and I'm not against death in drama. I mean, I've killed. I think every play of mine, I've killed someone.
Sure, you must have a birth and a death, as I always think is a good rule for a play.
But I felt there was room for other stuff on television, stuff that I wanted to watch. And so I thought the opposite of death is birth. So, and I wanted to write something about a big, messy family. So I just got the idea of an obstetrician and threw her into the middle of this big, messy family and pitched the idea to the producer, John Edwards.
And the rest is history.
Well, no, the rest was then 4 years in which no network wanted the show.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was history.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a funny world when you've been around a long time. You get very sanguine about the ups and downs of it all.
It was such a relief to me when that came on. I can remember my excitement when the first episode went to air because it was funny, it was smart, it was well written, it was well acted.
Yes, they're so good, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, there's something wrong with a lot of acting on Australian television. No one ever says this, but I watch acting, sometimes I think, that is not good. You know, you're not acting well. There's something about the directing or the rehearsal process or something that's missing. But I never felt that in Offspring. It's so well acted. And the sense of comedy is so acute, both from you and from the performers. So what other elements do you reckon you got right?
I was lucky enough that I had two amazing co-writers who worked on the show with me, Jonathan Gavin and Michael Lucas and other people. So I think that there is a kind of alchemy about a certain team of cast and directors and writers that works. I think people really wanted a sense of community, the sense that all those very flawed people ultimately cared about each other, even though they behaved appallingly at times. The family and that workplace community ultimately cared about each other, and I think people are drawn to that because people yearn for that.
Yeah.
And I think that mix of comedy and drama is appealing to people because, in a way, it's appealing to me because that feels more like real life and reflecting the way we're all moving around in the world.
You know, when I first met you, which was in 1980, I thought you were marvellous. I still think you're marvellous.
Well, you said that as if you no longer do.
No. I realised that was the tone of my voice and I rapidly corrected myself.
Now you've let everyone know how old we are, wretchedly old.
I know. We're at ANU. You were an undergraduate. I'm a bit older because I was a postgraduate there. And what I thought was fantastic about you was that you were already, as a student, in paid work as a writer. You were writing some drama or something for the ABC. This was in the days when there was ABC drama.
I flogged my first radio play. play to the ABC when I was 17. So I partly financed university through radio.
Right.
Yeah. So no wonder I like radio. I've just made that connection. Yes, I fixed on being a playwright when I was 12.
Right.
I've since revised that. I'm no longer a playwright, but I fixed, certainly fixed on being a writer when I was very young. When I think I was too young to know that you didn't do that.
Well, you have written a lot of plays for the theatre.
I have.
Do you feel as though you've found your medium now with TV?
I feel like the two things that I'm most enjoying as a consumer, the two things are really good television drama and novels. And so I want to write in the media that are exciting me. And right. I think television drama at the moment is fantastic, and novels at the moment are very satisfying and interesting, and I love that. So I want to do those things.
As we wind up, let's return to your novel, Useful.
Yes.
How relaxed are you yourself about giving away your organs?
Look, like Natalie in the book, I'm a walking organ farm for my children, so I can't give away my organs because I have children. But if I didn't have children, I would give away my organs. I can't give away blood because I lived in England in the mad cow years.
Oh, so did I.
I know. It's very annoying because I would love to be able to give blood.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I think, come on, the mad cow thing can't still be there.
Those poms and their mad cows. Mm.
Good Lord, that's a note to end on. Perhaps that could be the premise of the next series. Deborah Oswald, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Michael.
Deborah Oswald, her new book is called Useful. It's published by Penguin. Look out for it. It's got an absolutely lovely cover. This is RN. This is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart. And we're with you 6 days a week, Monday to Friday at 10 and Saturdays at 2. Now, how are you going with The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy, the book that won the Man Booker Prize back in 1997? It's the first book we're reading this year in our Subcontinent Book Club. We're meeting on the last Friday of every month, and we're reading a book from India or Pakistan or places adjacent there too. And we'll be reading The God of Small Things on the 27th of February. So do get reading if you haven't started already. Well, like Arundhati Roy, our next guest has burst onto the literary scene with a very bold debut. Dipti Kapoor's novel is called A Bad Character, and it's a story of 21st century India. It's about drugs and sex and abuse and the limits of women's freedom in the world's most populated city, Delhi. Dipti Kapoor has been surprised at the support that the book has received in some quarters, but she's also had some, well, unexpected criticism. The ABC's Eleanor Hall, who of course is the presenter of the current affairs program The World Today, speaks to Dipti Kapoor at the Jaipur Literature Festival. Dipti begins with a reading from the opening page.
My boyfriend died when I was 21. His body was left lying broken on the highway up of Delhi while the sun rose in the desert to the east. I wasn't there. I never saw it. But plenty of others saw. And they wrote about him in the paper. 12 lines buried in the middle pages. One line standing out. The last one, in which a cop he'd never met said to the reporter, "He was known to us. He was a bad character."
Dipti Kapoor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Your novel, A Bad Character, is a daring book addressing issues like drugs and sexual abuse. Why did you write it?
My first boyfriend, which was an extremely exhilarating, passionate relationship, which turned violent. He died. And I think just before he died, my father also died. So I had these two extremely, intense experiences with death. So when I started to write it, I wanted to fix a portrait of this amoral, subterranean, underground Delhi, the places that people don't normally talk about. I find that Indian novelists, they always want to write this idea that you have to have that big family novel or a novel that or a story that brings in the history of the country. I didn't want to talk about any of that. It's just the story of a girl in the city.
So what is a bad character in Indian terms?
It's interesting because it's a term you use or you hear often. It's almost a phrase that throwaway phrase that people use when they want to describe, say, a woman comes back home late, becomes a bad character. A policeman will describe a thief, or anyone will say, "Oh, you know, he did this. He's a bad character." If you live in India, you hear it all the time.
oh, he's a very bad character. So it was an ironic title, but it was also a sad title. It's like a melancholic. So what if she's a bad character? And it's also about the city, because here in that character, I mean, Delhi is also, say, bad. And it's a city which lends itself to people behaving a certain way. You know, I don't think that I could have written this in any other city. I couldn't have placed this story in any other city in the world.
There is a sense from the book in which you hate Delhi. I mean, you talk about the sun sinking into the rotting river. Is that fair? Do you really hate this city?
I don't. I have a love-hate relationship with it. I see beauty and terror as you know, opposite ends of the same lines. Delhi has this kind of tragic, beautiful, decaying sense about it, which is what I wanted to write about. And of course, and then there's also the horrible bits, especially when she's alone later, when you can feel that male gaze and she can feel the predatory glances.
In your novel, the girl in the building opposite dies trying to escape. It seems to graphically sum up the desperation of women in India for freedom. So how much freedom do middle-class girls in Delhi have?
You know, the freedom is like, okay, you can go to the cinema and then you can come back home. What I find, though, is most girls, even if they have a certain amount of freedom, they live their lives in secrecy. Maybe they can have boyfriends or they can have even lovers, but most of the time the families won't know anything about them, and then you have, and they eventually do get married to someone the family chooses. On the whole, it's still an extremely conservative society. Women are expected to behave a certain way. And if they don't, if they fall off the path, then their marriage prospects are dimmed. There was a girl who lived just above our apartment. Her father used to keep her locked up, and she was trying to escape. I remember being in my room, and we heard the thud, and then everyone ran down. And what's happening now, I find, is because Delhi is such a violent city, and of course it's always in the news, the rape capital of India, girls are being told that you can't go out because you will get attacked. So not only you know, there's the idea that if you there are restrictions placed on you because there's a certain morality, but there's also the fact that it is an extremely dangerous city.
Would you read for us that section where you're writing about the dangers of a woman driving alone?
This is one of my favorite passages. This passage annoyed a lot of women. It's not a feminist passage. I mean, this is a book about desire and trauma, but it's not, I mean, there's an implicit sort of feminist strain running through it. But if you look at it just on the surface, you think that this is this girl who's taking all these stupid risks, and she's taking drugs, and she's having sex, and, you know, what kind of message is she giving? So I sometimes read this passage just to annoy people. This book is a provocation, so I'm going to read it now. With coke in my blood and my brain, I take to driving fast into the night. Suddenly coming to a stop at the red light, here two men pull up alongside me on a bike. They look inside the car. I know the wild excitement they must feel when they see me alone in here. The bike's engine revs. The light is still red. So do I drive? Do I look at them? The last thing I should do is look at them. I turn my head and I look at them. As soon as I do, their eyes widen in pleasure, and the passenger grips the rider's waist, holds him and says something into his ear. The bike veers away in a loop. Like a kennel of dogs, they howl and bang on the glass with the palms of their hands. Then the pillion rider tries to open the door. Although the light is still red, I put my foot down on the gas. The motorbike does the same, following me at speed, flashing its lights and beeping the horn, and I can hear the men wailing on top of it. The road ahead is empty, the wide road deserted. I see the bike coming to my side and jerk towards it, forcing it to brake. Then I take my chance and floor it, drive straight through the light and the traffic. Behind in the mirror, I watch the bike being hit by a car side on at speed, a police van far behind with flashing lights, and the bike and the men spilling out on the road.
Wow. So what would have happened if she hadn't run that light and the bike hadn't crashed?
Well, if they had managed to stop her, anything could have happened. I mean, if they would have just taken her somewhere. There's this threat of violence everywhere. in Delhi, it's very implicit as well. You can feel this male gaze, you can feel the eyes, the glances all over you. I find it like a black fog just following you around everywhere. And I find it more in Delhi than any other city in India.
How do you think it is that you say feminists don't like that passage?
I would say, some feminists, I'm not saying, in India there's a certain idea that if you're a feminist or if you're talking about rights, then it has to be in an extremely direct way. What I'm trying to say is that you should have the right to take risks. I've always said, I want to be able to plan my own destruction. And this is an idea, Indian women are still quite conservative. I'm considered lucky, I'm privileged, I had a really good education, yet I write a novel where a girl is bored. She makes stupid decisions, the girl in the novel. But because when I think as in India, women are supposed to be a certain way, you know. If you're a feminist, then you have to fight for the cause in the right, correct way. I've had a couple of women, a few women, really annoyed. I have really provoked them. And this is not the kind of reaction I anticipated. I thought there'd be some right-wing Hindu men getting upset with the book. And it's been interesting. Once you place a book in the world, you don't know what kind of reaction it's going to get and who's going to have problems with it. It's also the way it's been written, I think, because you can talk about abuse and violence, but here it doesn't really say this is bad. And I think that has annoyed women. Also the fact that in the end, she doesn't get redeemed or punished. There's no message, you know. And this is what I wanted to... I didn't want the novel to have a message, because also there's all this idea of Indian women have to behave in a certain way. So this is a girl who doesn't behave and nothing happens to her. So maybe women felt betrayed by the end.
Now there's the issue of the rape of women in taxis making the headlines, and there's a lot of outrage about that, and the government does seem to be responding. Is it making a difference?
Well, the government responds, I feel, with extremely, like, you know, it's a band-aid that they put on the problem, but they don't really attack the core. The core is, I mean, it's an institutional problem. Education at, I think, school level all over India. There's a large-scale migration from rural to urban India. So that a lot of these people who are, say, the attackers or are men who've grown up in extremely conservative societies where their wives or mothers almost live behind in parda and don't talk back. And then they come to Delhi or Bombay and they see these women out there and they're driving and they're having coffee and they're in bars and they're drinking. And then maybe one of them is a taxi driver and he's seen this woman and he's like, well, she's fair game. India is also an extremely repressed society, so if you don't start doing something, nothing is going to change. I also find that a lot of people in government are men, and old conservative men. So I don't know whether they really believe what they say. It's also because, you know, it's in the news, the media takes it up, everyone's watching internationally. So they say these things, but nothing really happens. So this is the problem.
In your novel, you talk about the Holi festival being a sort of exuberant time of childhood and then being turned against children in a sort of a revenge. What do you mean?
So, have you ever seen Holi in India? So, you know, it's like when they're playing with colours and then they can, you know, I find that often something that's extremely joyous, especially when you're young and you love to do this, you know, play and smear each other with colour, spills over into violence. So you suddenly have these drunk men out on the road who come and start touching you. I mean, it didn't happen to me, but I've seen it around me. I mean, this was like the implicit, I suppose, political stand I was taking, that, you know, something like this can easily spill over into sexual violence. And also about the fact that young girls are extremely vulnerable in India. So that was, you know, that was what I was trying to say, that this incredible festival can suddenly become extremely terrifying. My grandma told me these stories, and this is when she was working in the government as a doctor, and she would get phone calls in the middle of the night, and there'd be a young girl. She'd been abused because she had to go out in the fields. And then my grandmother would be called to make sure. I mean, some of them, I mean, my grandma said there was one five-year-old. And then they had to sew her up. And it was awful. I mean, and then she'd be called to testify. And she always, well, now she's 90, and I don't know how much of it is true, but she says, I always made sure, like, the defense lawyers would try and embarrass her by talking about, you know, trying to embarrass her by bringing out details that she wouldn't be able to answer, but, you know, she doesn't care. So she said, I always got them put in prison.
A history of gutsy women in your family.
Yes, yes, I hope so.
Deepti Kapoor's book is called A Bad Character. It's published by Random House, and thanks to the ABC's Eleanor Hall for that terrific interview. On RN, this is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart.
Hi, I'm Michael Williams. Get your weekend off to a great start with Blueprint for Living. Coming up on the show this week, we look at some bad behaviour getting in the way of the good life. Why is it so hard for Australian designers to protect their intellectual property? Some say design theft is rife. Are our laws too lax? And why are vandals hitting gardens both public and private? What kind of person kills a 400-year-old tree? All that and more, Saturday morning at 9, here on RN.
And this is Books and Arts. Coming up, Justin Hazelwood reflects on what it's really like being an artist in Australia.
No one owes you a living. If you want to choose that path, then off you go. I'm not sure whether to feel sorry for you or not. Who is this self-absorbed crybaby plonker? Get him off. Unemployed, life as an artist in Australia.
Yes, that's ABC Morning presenter in Melbourne, John Fain, who was not very taken with our next guest when Fain interviewed him on his program. Well, it's a tough life being an artist. Not only do you have to create, but nowadays you have to market yourself at every turn. From social networking to real-life schmoozing, creative people are being told more and more that they have to put down their brushes or lay down their pens, leave the computer and join the conversation and build their brand. Well, writer and musician Justin Hazelwood, also known as the Bedroom Philosopher, investigates the emotional effect of treating yourself as a product. Today we're hearing part one of his eight-part series. It's called Fun Employed, named after his book of the same name, which we'll be featuring here on Books and Arts. This episode is called Sell Yourself.
Sitting out on the swing seat, thighs scorching like almonds, Nan would nurse a glass of home brew and impart her backyard philosophies. She knew I wanted to be a writer, and with knowledge gleaned from the author bios in her library books, she prepped me for the industry. You're going to have to sell yourself, Justin. At 12, with my bowl cut and smooth legs, this sounded daunting. I was shy. Wouldn't someone else do that for me? I thought. If you're talented enough, surely it would all take care of itself. I pictured myself in the doorway of a TV executive's office, clutching a manila folder. G'day, I'm Justin. I'm really good. Danny DeVito frowns and slams down his cigar.
Hey kid, I've had 10 Justins in here this week. Now get out of my office.
Fast forward 10 years and there I was, hawking my artistic wares on the front steps of Melbourne Town Hall. It was Melbourne International Comedy Festival 2004. In my hot hands was a wad of flyers, emblazoned with my startled face. Hi, sorry to interrupt your life. Here's a funny show.
Oh, is that you?
Yep.
So, you're funny? Can you tell us a joke?
No, I just do songs.
Like Dennis Leary?
No.
What's it about?
Me and my quirky life.
What's one of your songs about?
Golden Gay Times? As a performer, it's important to remember that you're also part of the retail and marketing sector. For the sensitive Australian artist, this is an irksome equation. Akin to standing naked at the primary school tuck shop holding a tray of wobbly Mars bar slices saying, sorry, can you buy these? Great pitch.
Your self-promotion is probably one of the most horrific parts of being an artist.
Warwick Thornton, filmmaker.
It's a dirty job and you have to do it, but and you feel really bad and you should have a long shower after you do it every time.
The energy and so forth it takes to self-promote, some people have, and they have that relentless belief in themselves.
Damien Cowell of TISM.
I have a parrot on my shoulder constantly saying to me, you're shit. So what I need is someone else to sort of take on that role of spruiking me.
It starts with making a thing, and if it's animation, it takes a long time to make the thing.
Cartoonist David Blumenstein.
I need to get it out there. How do I get it out there? I have to promote myself, but I don't like promoting myself. Can I hire someone to promote myself? No, I can't, because I can't afford one. I have to do it. All right, I'll do it. I'll do it half-assed, and then eventually, if I manage to wake up, I can actually sort of get out there and say what I do, and I'm doing it now, and it's going real well. Mm. So, yeah.
You mean this moment?
Or this very moment here, I'm trying to describe what I do, and it's difficult enough.
Australia is a country that prides itself on being humble and not blowing its own horn, unless you're at the cricket. Artists find themselves in conflict with the national psyche, ingrained in their DNA. To appease this tension, we've devised a passive-depressive sales technique, making self-deprecating pitches in a bid to offset any big noting. It's the great Aussie unsell. Evelyn Morris of Pikelet.
I mean, I remember things, you know, like when you're in primary school or whatever. There was this time where I like won something on the radio, like a Discman, and I went to school and I told everybody about it, stood in the front of class, and everyone was just like, you're so up yourself.
Oh, no.
I think I still have the same relationship to it. I'm still a bit like, yeah, I just spent like 3 years on an album. It's like, I mean, whatever.
It's funny. Do you feel like the more you do it, the better you get at it? Or is it this perpetual state of arrested development?
I
feel worse at it as I go along.
Oh, right.
Honestly, the more I go about it, the more neurotic I get.
It's not uncommon to receive a promotional group email opening with an apology. Sorry for the spam, but this marketing juxtaposition has often been a pet hate of mine. If you're truly sorry, then just don't send it in the first place. We're all adults. Commit.
It's an Australian thing.
Gareth Liddard of The Drones.
If you talk about the same thing to an American, they'd be like, yeah, I've got a publicist, like, you know, same as I've got a guitar. Yeah, plus I'm cool. Yeah. Australians, you won't hear him do that. No way. Yeah, they've got a real guilt trip about everything. It's a colonial mentality.
Playwright Lally Katz.
Funny, when I have meetings in the States and I kind of do the thing that I would do in a meeting in Australia, they just kind of look at me like, why are you here? If you're not great or whatever, then why are we meeting? You know, like, what's the point? And then I leave thinking, I really should try to hammer things home a bit more rather than sort of being coy and modest.
Jim Trail, who recorded my segments on Triple J, once told me, it's when people haven't quite got you worked out that you've got their attention. I carried this philosophy into my marketing, often going to great lengths to appear cryptic and aloof. Most of this backfired. On my first album, In Bed With My Doona, I wrote the title of my single, I'm So Postmodern, in Wingdings. It meant that DJs couldn't find the track. On the album's spine, instead of the title, I had Play Me, Play Me, Play Me, which is the album name Richard Kingsmill read on air. It's hard to resist taking the piss in blurbs and bios. The alternative means taking yourself seriously. Throughout my career, journalists have repeatedly asked whether I'm a musician or a comedian. I've gone out of my way to not answer them and to not know. Warwick Thornton, filmmaker.
You have to explain yourself as this sort of, everything has to have this perfect yin and yang realization of how it grew and how it became, and it's, you know, this has come from the pits of your pain and you've sort of brought it out by, you know, sort of bloodletting, and it's you know, it's crucifixion, and it's all sort of incredibly violent how you got to that place, and you know, you could be painting daisies.
Writer Laura Jean McKay.
I suppose I want the work to speak for itself, and I want to be recognised for the work, not because I've marched into a bookshop and I've got pizzazz and presence and I said something sassy. I'm a writer foremost, not a speaker, as you can probably tell right now. And I work hard on my words, and that's where I want my recognition to come from.
In 2012, I had a series of meetings with potential managers. I was in a bad way, burned out, in debt, and feeling particularly hopeless. It was not the best state to be pitching my business. At a management agency, three middle-aged women sat me down on a couch and peered over their glasses. "So, Justin, why are you here?" I politely rambled my story, explaining the struggles of swinging between the comedy and the music scenes, that I was now writing a book and I wanted to work in TV. I needed an experienced mentor to oversee the direction of my career. I ended up speaking about the Comedy Festival Roadshow of 2009 and how I hadn't enjoyed it. "I don't do well in regional areas. They don't really appreciate irony," I said. The women glanced at each other. "You're not exactly selling yourself." 12-year-old Justin shook his head.
"If you're going to be in the sort of work I do, then you need to work out a self which can be promoted, which may not be the you that lives in your house and takes your dog for a walk."
John Clark.
"There's a slightly performative self, and you need to develop one you can live with. So there's a slight negotiation there. But if you're going to have any role in public, you need to think about who you are, which parts of who you are you would like to keep a little bit private, and which parts of who you are that you could perhaps heighten."
As the artist, you're essentially the product, the salesperson, and the journalist covering the whole operation. Wise men say those with too many hats have heavy head. Performers sell themselves every time they climb on stage, convincing the audience their art is something they need in their lives. This exchange feels alive and organic. The key is finding an extension from the stage to the desk. If I had my time over again, I would try to embrace the system sooner. Pride is the best point of sale.
"I've become better at it purely out of desperation to sell stuff."
Liz Stringer.
"Yeah, I realised that I've needed to embrace certain things that don't come naturally to me, purely to have some kind of sound amongst the noise that's happening at the moment."
"I met him high on a hill when I was 16, and my breath, it was taken by the cold August wind. I left school..."
It kind of goes against my instincts, but I also need to eat, so... it is full of conflict for me, though. And I've been lucky to work with... I have a manager now, and I've had another manager in the past who were both on the same page with me as far as... me not wanting to do anything that was remotely not who I was, or present myself any differently, or do things that I'm really uncomfortable with. So that's, I've had a good crew that have understood that, which has been important.
I think back to the swing seat with Nan. Her garden was the big day out for colour. Simply red, deep purple, the white stripes, blooming like paper fireworks. Perhaps I'd remembered her words wrong. Maybe she'd said, "You'll have to learn to sell yourself, Justin." I wonder if you can teach an old heart new tricks.
There's a period where you need to camp down with yourself and completely drink your own Kool-Aid. You've got to believe in yourself.
I'm selling myself like I'm a bottle of milk. I'm milking myself like I'm a cash cow, forced to sell farm when its owner lost interest. All milk looks the same, so I've got to think about labelling. Super dupe milk, yeah, it's you, Butte's got a pretty blue picture of a little girl crying. Don't cry over skim milk. I spilt a glass of myself all over the keyboard, and now the eye is stuck. I'm shelling myself like I'm a hermit crab, painting the shell and selling it to the guy who sells the shells on the seashore black market. Now I'm a slug all dry and encrusted with sand. Shelter I seek inside a Coke can. Now I'm being paid for unique branded content. Don't cry over skim milk. The milk of human cowness is all over the keyboard. Now the M and the O are stuck. I'm selling myself like I'm a used car salesman. More hits than Elvis, there's miles on the Speedo. I'm wearing Speedos, oh God, someone help me. Interview Miss Universe, anxiety dream. I tell all the girls how I changed the world. Yada yada, hand jobs, please buy my album. Don't lie over middle class guilt. I write in the third person and second guess the first one, and write till there's no one left.
Soundtrack by Richard In Your Mind. Bottle of Milk is a new song by the Bedroom Philosopher from his Fun Employed LP, which will be released on the 20th of March by MGM. And we've just been enjoying episode one of Justin Hazelwood's series Fun Employed. And if you'd like more details of that project, including the list of Justin's guests, head along to the Books and Arts homepage. Everything you need to know is right there. And if you tune in next Thursday, you can listen to episode two, which is all about an experience which many artists will recognise, the sad experience of rejection. Well, that's Books and Arts for today. Don't forget the Facebook page. You can talk to us on Facebook. You can rap with us on Twitter. And, of course, there's always the website where you can leave your comments, and you can download audio there as well, of course. Now, tomorrow we're going to talk to the playwright and actor Lally Katz. She's going to chat about writing a libretto for The Rabbits. This is an extraordinary production because it's based on a tiny little book, a beautiful book, by Sean Tan and John Marsden. And Lally has turned it into an opera, which is going to be on at the Perth Festival. So I don't know how she's done that, but we'll find out tomorrow. As you know, Bush Telly is no more. Now each weekday at 11, we have the chance to enjoy documentary radio at its scintillating best. The new show is called Earshot, and today we're looking at the question of secular education in Australia. Does God have a place in the classroom? That's coming up straight after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN. Bye-bye.